Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading this week from the February 9th, 2018 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows two men in tinfoil hats. In the foreground is Congressman Devin Nunes, and in the background it is Sean Hannity, the Fox News reporter. He's looking at a whiteboard that has deep state, and it has the Russia investigation, has some conspiracy theories detailed, and the title says, Trump's Truthers, the Tinfoil Hat Campaign to Discredit Mueller's Russia investigation. We get to that in the controversy of the week, but we will start with a main story about the State of the Union address. Toned down Trump calls for unity. What happened? After a turbulent first year in office, President Trump this week used his first State of the Union address to urge Democrats to set politics aside and pass bipartisan legislation on infrastructure and immigration. In a speech in which he also boasted about eliminating the disastrous core of Obamacare, vowed to keep out dangerous immigrant criminals, and questioned the patriotism of kneeling NFL players. Trump touted his administration's campaign of maximum pressure against North Korea, as well as the creation of 2.4 million new domestic jobs and the passage of a tax bill that he promised would give millions of workers more take-home pay. This is our new American moment, said Trump. He urged Democrats to support a $1.5 trillion infrastructure deal and pitched his own down-the-middle compromise on immigration that would give 1.8 million undocumented dreamers a path to citizenship in exchange for $25 billion in border wall spending, an end to the diversity visa lottery, and limits on family reunification policies. Trump earned groans from some Democrats when he then spoke at length about illegal immigrants and criminal gangs, including MS-13, stating that his primary duty was to protect Americans, because Americans are dreamers too. While Republicans greeted Trump's remarks with standing ovations, most Democrats responded with stony-faced silence. More than a dozen Democratic lawmakers boycotted the event to protest Trump's reported reference to Haiti and African countries as, quote, shitholes. Representative Joe Kennedy, a Democrat from Massachusetts, the grandson of Robert F. Kennedy, delivered the party's official response, accusing Trump of deepening the fault lines of a fractured country. What the editorial said, have a president's words ever rung more hollow, said the Washington Post. Trump's first State of the Union was pitched as a search for unity, an appeal for one American family. Yet our petulant president couldn't avoid, even for an hour, peppering his address with gratuitous attacks and divisive references to hot-button issues, including his thinly veiled dig about football players who refuse, he said, to proudly stand for the national anthem. As far as addresses go, this one offered little reason to hope that Trump's second-year tactics would be more constructive than those of his first. Actually, this was a largely disciplined performance by Trump, said the Wall Street Journal. after beginning his presidency with a dark inaugural dirge about American carnage, Trump played against type this week by making an optimistic bid for common ground on infrastructure, prison reform, and other issues. He even offered some generous concessions on immigration, which Democrats have already foolishly rejected. Of course, one reasonable speech is no guarantee of future comportment, but if Trump can maintain this approach, his presidency and country will be better off. What the columnist said. Presidents always claim that the State of the Union is strong, said Ned Roan in TheHill.com. Yet Trump has more reason than others to boast, particularly where the economy is concerned. Unemployment is at a 45-year low, and even some of the president's biggest critics have grudgingly admitted that Trump's tax cuts will spark 4% growth next year. And he's achieved all of this despite the nonstop assault of many in the mainstream media. Could this be a turning point? Asked Ed Rogers in WashingtonPost.com. Trump himself seems less manic these days. There have been fewer crazy tweets of late, and before this week's well-received address, the president gave a powerful performance at Davos. After months of chaos, is Trump about to get up on the board and catch a wave? Don't bet on it, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Despite the healthy economy, Trump's approval rating is still historically low, at under 40%, because voters see through his empty promises. Trump vowed to serve the forgotten people, but his tax cut overwhelmingly benefits corporations and the rich. Job growth actually lags that of President Obama's last year. Trump landed two of his State of the Union guests for adopting a baby born to opioid addicts, but he has done nothing to tackle this national crisis. Affordable health care, lower prescription prices, better trade deals, everything this master con man says he is doing for you lies off in the future. And going to our controversy of the week, Trump's defenders, the deep state conspiracy theory. Even for a nation with a venerable tradition of conspiracy theories, said Jeet here in NewRepublic.com, America is entering into a dangerous new era. As Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation closes in on President Trump, the paranoid ravings about a deep state coup are now coming straight from the power centers in the White House and GOP. Trump stooge Representative Devin Nunes, Republican from California, is leading the way with a warrant to conduct surveillance of Trump campaign staff as they talked to and met with Russians. But Nunes has plenty of accomplices in his campaign to protect Trump at all costs. Republican Senator Ron Johnson last week jumped on a report that two FBI agents had mentioned a secret society in text messages to warn Americans that FBI agents were holding secret meetings off-site, presumably to plot against the president. The next day, Johnson backed off his claim when it became clear the secret society reference in the text was a joke. Nonetheless, Sean Hannity and other Fox News anchors stayed in full tinfoil hat mode, delivering fevered nightly calls for the purging and jailing of anti-Trump conspirators. What's more disturbing, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post, is that even mainstream Republicans, including House Speaker Paul Ryan, are echoing Hannity's call to cleanse the FBI. To defend Trump, Republicans are putting partisanship over sanity. Republicans aren't the desperate ones here, said Kimberly Strassel in WSJ.com. The imminent release of Nunes' memo has sent Trump's enemies into a panic. They realize their own conspiracy theory that Trump colluded with Russia to steal the 2016 election won't survive some sunlight. So they're smearing Republicans as raving paranoids. The good news is that these frantic reactions are a sign Americans are getting closer to the truth. I'm no fan of either Trump or conspiracy theories, said Kevin Williamson in NationalReview.com, but the FBI does not deserve blind trust. In their text exchanges, since fired FBI agents Peter Strzok and Lisa Page spoke of developing an insurance policy in the unlikely event Trump was elected. What did that mean? As the Mueller investigation proceeds, we need total transparency by everyone involved, including the investigators. To believe in the deep state conspiracy, said Amanda Carpenter in Politico.com, you have to believe that Mueller, a lifelong Republican and decorated Marine war hero with an impeccable reputation, is leading a plot by Hillary Clinton sympathizers to overthrow the president. Why is my party gaslighting America? Republicans contracted their conspiratorial mindset directly from President Trump, said Mona Charon in NationalReview.com, a man who to this day insists, without a shred of evidence, that millions of illegals voted against him in 2016. Defend this shameless president if you must, Republicans, but don't become him. It's too late, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. Large numbers of Republicans have been willing to entertain outlandish and ludicrous tales since the 1990s, when they insisted the Clintons had murdered Vince Foster. From there, it's a straight line to birtherism, Benghazi, and last year's bizarre Pizzagate theory that Hillary Clinton was running a child's sex trafficking ring. Not all Republicans tumble down these rabbit holes, but many do. And the party's leaders clearly see the deep state conspiracy as their best defense against whatever charges Mueller may bring in the Russia affair. They might not succeed in saving Trump from the truth, but they're going to go to any length to do it. Time for our good week, bad week feature. Was a good week for basic decency after an announcement by the Cleveland Indians that they will remove the grinning bug-eyed caricature Chief Wahoo from team uniforms in 2019. It was a good week for women after the word mansplaining was added to the Oxford English Dictionary. It describes the habit of some men to explain things needlessly, overbearingly, or condescendingly, especially to a woman, in a manner thought to reveal a patronizing or chauvinistic attitude. Almost no men believe they do this. And it was a good week for jury duty after extradited drug kingpin Joaquin El Chapo Guzman challenged a prosecution motion to keep jurors in his upcoming New York City trial anonymous on the grounds that he had no plans to order any of them killed. But it was a bad week for betting on yourself after Dr. Brenda Fitzgerald, the new director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, had to resign when it was revealed that she'd invested in tobacco and pharmaceutical company stock after taking the job in June. The CDC is supposed to discourage smoking and opioid abuse. It was a bad week for blockages after a flight from Oslo to Munich carrying 85 plumbers had to turn back because of a blocked toilet. The toilet repairs had to be done from the outside, one plumber said, and we didn't risk sending a plumber to work at 10,000 meters. And it was a bad week for wedding crashers after three Wisconsin men snuck into a wedding reception and began aggressively dancing with teenage girls. The incensed bride punched one of the crashers in the face, and he later told cops, "I probably deserved it." And while we're here, White House drops South Korea ambassador pick. The White House is no longer considering its original choice for U.S. Ambassador South Korea after he objected to the idea of launching a bloody nose strike on North Korea. The Trump administration had been expected to nominate Victor Cha, a respected academic who served in the George W. Bush administration and spent months vetting his background, going so far as to notify South Korean officials in December of the pending decision. But the White House reversed itself not long after, reportedly following Cha's objection to the idea of launching a preventative strike on North Korea, a strategy meant to deter its nuclear ambitions without triggering a full-scale war. Cha also objected to Trump's threats to abandon a bilateral trade deal with Seoul. An interesting title to our briefing page article. It's called Orwell Comes to China. China's 1.4 billion people are getting, quote, social credit scores that rate their trustworthiness and determine their place in society. What is social credit? It's similar to the credit score system familiar to many Americans, but along with financial information, China's version will take account of a person's political activity, social interactions, and purchase history. All that data is fed into a computer algorithm that calculates a citizen's trust score. Take care of your parents, pay your bills on time, and give to charity, and you'll be rewarded with a high rating, which can get you access to visas to travel abroad and good schools for your children. Run a red light, criticize the government on social media, or sell tainted food to customers, and you could lose access to bank loans, government jobs, and the ability to rent a car. Beijing aims to have the program running by 2020. Pilot versions are underway in some 30 cities. "This is like Big Brother," said Chinese novelist and social commentator Murong Zikun, who has all your information and can harm you in any way he wants. Why such a sweeping system? Partly it's because China wants to better control its freewheeling and poorly regulated economy, now the world's second largest. A social credit system will let the government easily punish business people who sell toxic baby formula or rotten meat, as well as bureaucrats who take bribes. "Swindlers have to pay a price," says Lian Weiliang, vice chairman of the National Development and Reform Commission. China also lacks a national equivalent of the FICO FICO scores that the U.S. lenders use to assess consumer credit risks. So most Chinese can get credit cards and loans only from their own bank. The social credit score system should result in more lending and less fraud. But for the Communist Party, social credit is mainly a way to push citizens toward approved behaviors, obeying the party, for example, or conserving energy. How will Beijing score behavior? By monitoring the wealth of data generated by citizens' smartphones. Many Chinese have given up on cash and almost exclusively use their phones to pay for goods and services. $5.5 trillion in mobile payments are made in China every year, compared with about $112 billion in the U.S. The most popular smartphone payment portals, Alipay and WeChat Pay, are much more than financial apps. These so-called super apps have built-in social networks and can be used to hail a cab, order food, schedule a doctor's appointment, or check into a hotel. All that data can be harvested and used to create a social credit score. E-commerce giant Alibaba, which owns Alipay, has already made a private version of the future government system called Sesame Credit. How does it work? An algorithm assigns users a score between 350 and 950. The higher the number, the more perks you get. Low scores have to pay larger deposits to do things like reserve hotel rooms, and they can be shut out of first-class seats on trains and planes. Personal factors weigh heavily. The degrees you hold, how much time you spend playing video games, and even your score, even the scores of your friends. So if your rating drops, your friends have an incentive to shun you, lest their scores dip too. Users can even link their scores to dating apps to screen to potential mates. The system, says Sesame Credit CEO Lucy Pang, will ensure that the bad people in society don't have a place to go, while good people can move freely and without obstruction. This is meant literally. Video surveillance will track everyone through facial recognition. How widespread is that technology? Some apartments already use facial recognition to unlock doors, and a growing number of restaurants let customers smile to pay. As more apps roll out, they will feed their data into a new government surveillance program called Sharp Eyes, a reference to Mao Zedong-era system of neighbors informing on one another. Security cameras, ubiquitous in stores and on street corners, will be integrated into that surveillance platform, and artificial intelligence will analyze the mountain of video data. Suspicious behavior will be flagged, potentially affecting the person's social credit score. If you know gambling takes place in a location, and someone goes there frequently, said Li Jifeng of the facial recognition firm CloudWalk, they could become suspicious. What if the algorithm makes a mistake? The consequences will be dire. One element that will be merged into the social credit system is the Supreme People's Court blacklist of more than 7 million people who have outstanding fines or judgments. Journalist Liu Hu discovered he was on that list last year when he found himself unable to book a flight on a travel app. It turned out that he had entered an incorrect account number when paying a fine, and the result was a blanket ban from all travel except the worst seats on the slowest trains. He has since paid the fine correctly but remains on the blacklist. Other people have been blacklisted for minor offenses, including one man who had shoplifted $70 worth of cigarettes. Lin Junyu, an academic seen as the father of social credit theory, says such mistakes and excesses are unfortunately inevitable. Yet, compared with the improvement in the atmosphere of the entire society, he adds, their sacrifice is worth it. Time for a few columns now. The first two from the U.S. this week. Hillary's hashtag MeToo hypocrisy by Ruth Marcus at the Washington Post. If anyone needed a reminder of the Clintons' inability to take personal responsibility for their failings, said Ruth Marcus, consider the ugly case of Burns Strider. The New York Times reported last week that Hillary Clinton refused to fire Strider, the, quote, faith advisor to her 2008 presidential campaign, when he was accused of repeatedly sexually harassing a young female campaign worker. The married Strider's creepy behavior was so egregious that Clinton's campaign manager and other top aides urged that he be sent packing. Instead, he was docked several weeks' pay and ordered to undergo counseling. Years later, Strider was hired to run a pro-Clinton super PAC. Big surprise. More harassment of young subordinates, which finally led to his firing. Faced with these revelations, Clinton last week issued an infuriatingly bland statement saying she was dismayed when the first incident occurred, but heartened that the women stepped forward because all women deserve to be heard. When I read that, I wanted to let out a primal scream. Clinton should have immediately admitted that she was wrong to keep Strider employed and that she'd failed her female employees, and acknowledged that we've all learned painful lessons from the hashtag MeToo movement. Unfortunately, that Hillary Clinton doesn't exist. And David Brooks at the New York Times writes, "The big lie about immigration. As an advocate of moderation, I'd like to be able to claim there's a reasonable middle ground on immigration," said David Brooks. "But when you wade into the evidence, you find that the case for restricting immigration is pathetically weak. Restrictionists insist the country currently has too many immigrants, both legal and illegal, and that they're competing for jobs and eroding America's culture. But let's look at rural America, from New England down to Appalachia and over to the upper Midwest. These places are often 95% white, with few immigrants. And they're thriving? Quite the opposite. These are some of our country's most blighted communities, with few new businesses and jobs, widespread family breakdown, and rampant opioid addiction. Immigrants, on the other hand, show far more traditional American values than the native-born. Ambitious and optimistic, they start new businesses at twice the rate of non-immigrants, have fewer out-of-wedlock children, and commit less crime. The second and third generations of Hispanic and Asian immigrants are indeed assimilating, intermarrying, and even identifying themselves as white. It's no wonder that some native-born Americans resent immigrants who are proving that the American dream still works if you're willing to do anything to succeed." And one from Japan, "Oil spill shows need for crisis team. The oil leaking from the sunken tanker Sanchi will pollute Japanese waters for years," said the Japan Times. The Panama-registered supertanker was carrying nearly 1 million barrels of ultralight, highly flammable condensate oil from Iran to South Korea, as well as about 1,000 tons of its own more toxic bunker fuel. When it collided with a freighter in the East China Sea in early January, the Sanchi burst into flames, killing all 32 members, and drifted into Japan's exclusive economic zone before it exploded and sank. A massive spill now covers more than 100 square miles and could reach the Japanese coast in a month. It has already poisoned waters that are an important spawning ground for fish and crab, crucial to the Japanese fishing industry, as well as a migratory pathway for whales. New rules requiring vessels traveling through our own waters to have stronger hulls or to stay farther away from other ships won't prevent such disasters because collisions occur on what is technically the high sea, subject only to lax rules based on whatever flag of convenience a ship flies. That's why Japan must partner with China and South Korea to create up-to-date oil spill recovery plans as well as fishery protections. No country can or should have to tackle these incidents alone. And our last word feature, titled this week, "The Dress That Drove the Slave Trade." When a portrait of Marie Antoinette wearing a simple muslin gown appeared in 1783, it caused a scandal, said writer Caroline London. It also ignited a feverish demand for cotton. Marie Antoinette is infamous for her lavish, over-the-top fashions. It is the first thing most people associate with the doomed queen. Skirts as wide as they are tall, paired with towering hairstyles, all draped in jewels and pearls. She was a fashion icon. If Marie wore a style, the rest of the court and the Western world followed suit. She had the power to make or break an entire industry just by deeming something fashionable. And though it wasn't her intention, that is exactly what she did. Yet despite all of Marie's extravagant fashions, it was her most unassuming look that changed the world forever. In 1783, portrait artist Elizabeth Louise Viguet Le Brun painted Marie in a simple cotton gown known as a robe de gaule. The thin white fabric is airy and loose, cinched at the waist with a sheer golden sash. Full sleeves and a softly ruffled neckline add volume to the otherwise unstructured shape. She doesn't wear any jewels or embellishments, just a wide-brimmed straw hat tied with a ribbon band, topped with a few relatively modest plumes. The painting has a graceful and Arcadian feel to it, at least to the modern eye. The scene is refreshingly natural when compared with the ornateness of the typical Rococo-era portrait. The gown gives off an aesthetic of rustic simplicity, writes Katie Werlin in Clothing and Fashion, American Fashion from Head to Toe. Despite its humble appearance, though, Marie's portrait of the plain cotton dress had an impact that reverberated throughout the world in ways no one could have foreseen. It flipped the textile industry on its head, lighting the fuse laid out by a fast-changing world of exploration, the Enlightenment, and rebellion. It caused cotton and the institution of slavery it stood on to explode. When Austrian-born Marie Antoinette was sent to France at just 15 years old to marry the Dauphin, she entered a world of extraordinary opulence. Versailles was home to the most lavish halls and grounds imaginable, and the people who occupied it dressed to match. Marie dressed as she was expected to, in the finest French silks with jewels fit for a future queen. She was not the first to wear the over-the-top styles. She was simply in a position to take them to levels with which even the most privileged members of the aristocracy could not compete. When Marie's husband, Louis XVI, ascended to the throne in 1774, he gifted Marie with the Petit Trianon, an idyllic chateau on the grounds of Versailles, first occupied by Louis XV's mistress, Madame du Barry. The Petit Trianon was Marie's personal escape. She was given complete control of the estate. Even the king could not enter if she did not invite him. Marie and her ladies would go there to step away from their lavish lifestyles and enjoy a simpler existence, undisturbed by the scrutiny and expectations of the court. Naturally, this extended to their clothing. They left their stiff silks behind in favor of light muslins and brightly patterned cotton chintz Indians. At this point in time, the vast majority of cotton came from India, hence Indians. And thanks to the East India Company, it was spread across Europe. Native Americans had grown cotton in the southern United States for centuries, and as the colonists took over the New World, they too grew small amounts of cotton, but very little was exported. Much of the American agricultural industry in its infancy was supported by indentured servants. While slavery certainly existed in the United States at the time of Marie Antoinette, its future was uncertain. Shortly after the American Revolution, the northern states outlawed slavery one by one, and for a brief time, it looked as though the southern states might do the same. That all changed as cotton began to rise. It is not surprising that Marie would choose to be painted in the fashion she wore in her private oasis. She was by no means the first to be depicted wearing the provincial cotton dress. that typified life at Petit Trianon. Within the French court alone, Vigée Le Brun painted a few aristocratic ladies in the gauzy gowns, including Madame de Berry in 1781, and the Duchess de Polignac, one of Marie's closest friends, in 1782 and 1783. These women were both already controversial figures to the people of France, and while their choice of cotton gowns stirred up some level of dissent, it was nothing compared with the uproar that exploded when Marie's cotton gown portrait was put on exhibition at the Salon of Académie Royale. The backlash was immediate. Salon visitors demanded the portrait be removed from public view, but the damage was already done. As Mary D. Sheriff states in The Exceptional Woman, Elizabeth Vigée Le Brun and the Cultural Politics of Art, Vigée Le Brun unwittingly showed Antoinette as an immodest woman, providing enemies with yet more evidence against the queen. There were many who saw the garment as alarmingly scandalous. It closely resembled a chemise, the simple dress that served as a base garment for women at the time. In other words, the queen appeared to be posing in her underwear. This accusation gave the cotton gown the name by which it is now most commonly known, the chemise à la reine, or the chemise of the queen. Beyond the shocking nature of the gown's design, the fabric itself was a source of major uproar. Many of her fellow aristocrats saw the queen in such an inexpensive textile as a breakdown of the barriers between the classes. More importantly, though, cotton was seen by the French as a very English fabric, since India was a British colony. Cotton chintz had risen in popularity throughout the century in Britain and was a fashionable choice on that side of the English Channel by the 1780s. Therefore, it was perceived as incredibly unpatriotic for the French queen to so openly wear cotton. Her loyalties were already under question due to her Austrian heritage, and this dress only confirmed her lack of French allegiance. The Queen's many critics were concerned that this choice would destroy the French silk industry. Despite the controversy, the 18th century fashionistas, who were unafraid to take risks, expanded the popularity of the chemise à la reine in The Art and Dress, Fashion in England and France, 1780-1820. Eileen Ribeiro recounts how Marie set chemise gowns to a few of her friends, including the famous British style icon Georgiana Cavendish, Duchess of Devonshire. Soon, what was once seen as scandalous was now seen as stylish, and the chemise à la reine became a popular choice of dress for women across Europe. Paired with the rising affinity for Greek and Roman culture brought on by the Enlightenment, the plain white dress quickly took over the fashion world. As everyone knows, Marie Antoinette was executed in 1793 for reasons that went far beyond her contentious dress. But although the queen was gone, the impact of her sartorial choice was just starting to make its mark. The people of France had been right to be concerned about the popularization of cotton and other muslins. Throughout the next two decades, the French silk industry suffered greatly. While the French Revolution had a massive impact on the economy across the board, the demand for silk both in France and abroad came crashing down as the simple white muslin dress became the leading style. However, as the revolution progressed, the general French perception of the patriotism associated with cotton completely reversed. As Carolyn Weber writes in her book, Queen of Fashion, What Marie Antoinette Wore to the Revolution, once condemned as ruinous to the domestic silk industry, muslin could now be worn as a sign of patriotic order, ardor, along with even cheaper stuffs like cotton and wool, since the nobility's costumes at the Estates General had marked sumptuous silks and velvets as enemies of the revolution. By the end of the century, cotton and muslin had nearly completely replaced silk as the fashionable fabrics of choice. Yet the fall of silk and rise of cotton had implications that reached much farther than the borders of France. The Indian cotton industry could no longer keep up with demand, so Europeans were forced to look elsewhere for their supply. Up until the end of the 18th century, tobacco and rice and other food products dominated the American agricultural industry. That all changed when the demand for cotton suddenly skyrocketed. While the simple cotton dress was rising in popularity, the Industrial Revolution was making major strides to aid in textile production. When Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin in 1794, suddenly there was the technical ability to process cotton at a rate to keep up with demand. All that was necessary was the workforce to pick large volumes of cotton so it could be processed by the gin. Of course, plantation owners looked to the cheapest possible option. The boom in agricultural industry caused a boom in slavery to support it. According to American Slavery, 1619 to 1877 by Peter Colchin, annual cotton production rose from about 3,000 bales in 1790 to 178,000 in 1810, then surged more than 20-fold during the next half century. The slave population increased in turn from about 654,000 slaves in the South in 1790 to more than 1.1 million in 1810, a number that continued to grow in the following decades. Marie Antoinette and her fellow fashion trendsetters made cotton desirable. Technology and slave labor made it affordable. It was the perfect storm. The affordability increased the desirability, resulting in an even higher demand, which in turn increased the mass production so that the price dropped even further. The cycle caused King Cotton and the institution of slavery that it stood upon to rule the South. Of course, we all know what happened from there. A simple dress launched an elaborate butterfly effect with far-reaching consequences that the young French queen never could have predicted when she took a step outside her lavish royal wardrobe. This was originally published in Racked.com. I'd like to read one of the obituaries for all of you fiction lovers out there. This is the novelist who conjured fantastic worlds, Ursula K. Le Guin, 1929 to 2018. Ursula K. Le Guin emerged from the 1960s to become a towering figure in the male-dominated world of science fiction and fantasy. While most of her contemporaries produced macho tales of good triumphing over evil, Le Guin was more interested in ideas of balance. Informed by her study of Taoism, gender, and culture conditioning, her 1969 novel, The Left Hand of Darkness, now taught widely in high schools and colleges, is set on a planet whose human-like inhabitants are neither male nor female. Her six-book Earth-Sea Cycle imagines a fantastical realm where magic is practiced with the precision and moral ambiguity of science. For Le Guin, the radical possibilities of science fiction and fantasy were the perfect tools for exploring our own changing world. At this point, she said in 1973, realism is perhaps the least adequate means of understanding or portraying the incredible realities of our existence. Ursula Kroeber was born in Berkeley, California, to anthropologist parents who studied Native American peoples, said the New York Times. At a young age, she immersed herself in books about mythology, classic fantasies, and the science fiction magazines of the day. After studying French and Italian literature at college, she won a Fulbright Fellowship to study in Paris, where she met her future husband, historian Charles Le Guin, said the Washington Post. Back in the U.S., she wrote realist poetry and short stories before returning to science fiction in the 1960s. Her first three novels disappeared almost without notice, but Le Guin's fourth, 1968's A Wizard of Earthsea, established her as a rising star and launched a best-selling series. Le Guin's fiction was often ahead of its time, said ArsTechnica.com. Her 1966 novel, Planet of Exile, about a world with 15-year-long seasons and creatures that attack from the icy north, presaged Game of Thrones. The word for world is forest in a 1972 Vietnam War critique in which humans invade a planet of nature-loving aliens seemed to inspire James Cameron's blockbuster movie Avatar. Awarded the Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters at the 2014 National Book Awards, Le Guin dedicated the honor to fellow writers of the imagination who had long been ignored by the literary establishment. I think hard times are coming when we will be wanting the voices of writers who can see alternatives to how we live now, she said, and even imagine some real grounds for hope. There are a couple of interesting articles on the Talking Points page, so I'd like to go ahead there now. We'll start with Nassar, How a Predator Got Away with Abuse for Decades. He gave them gifts, invited them back to his house, and brought them ice packs and wiped away the blood when they were injured, said Christine Hauser and Maya Salam in the New York Times. Over the years, young female gymnasts were told to view Dr. Lawrence G. Nassar as a sports medicine guru and magician who could relieve their pain and improve their performance. But last week, in a Michigan courtroom, 156 sister survivors lined up to tell graphic stories of the sexual abuse they suffered at the hands of the former U.S. Olympic and Michigan State osteopath. In the guise of medical treatment, Nassar molested girls and teens in various ways, but his specialty was, quote, pelvic manipulation, a process in which he aggressively penetrated girls as young as six, vaginally and anally, with his ungloved fingers, sometimes for as long as 15 minutes. In her testimony, Olympic gold medalist Allie Raceman stared Nassar down, saying, imagine how it feels to be an innocent teenager in a foreign country hearing a knock on the door, and it was you. Another Nassar victim, Kylie Stevens, said her father refused to believe her for years and then committed suicide over his failure to protect her. Little girls don't stay little forever, Stevens told Nassar. They grow into strong women that return to destroy your world. These brave young women finally received some justice when Nassar, 54, was sentenced to up to 175 years in prison. Nassar's lengthy prison sentence is just step one, said Sally Jenkins in the Washington Post. Step two is establishing why the U.S. Olympic Committee, the USOC, U.S. Gymnastics, and Michigan State enabled the biggest sexual abuse scandal in sports history. At least 14 Michigan State representatives received reports of sexual misconduct by Nassar as early as 1997, the Detroit News reported. These complaints weren't just ignored, said Steve Seibold in FoxNews.com. The anger was redirected at the girls, who were told they didn't understand the nuances of Nassar's intravaginal treatments. Meanwhile, Michaela Maroney was paid $1.25 million by USA Gymnastics to keep quiet. The USA Gymnastics board resigned in the wake of last week's hearing, but they and officials at the USOC and Michigan State should face possible criminal prosecution for protecting this monster. The gymnastics world has long valued medals over morals, said Hadley Freeman in TheGuardian.com. Consider the notoriously brutal regime at the Caroli Ranch in Texas, where Nasser carried out much of his abuse. Under fierce Romanian coaching legends Bella and Marta Caroli, young female Team USA athletes were so deprived of food and water, they would beg their male teammates to bring them snacks. These girls were groomed from a young age to ignore pain and to believe that suffering is the path to greatness. No wonder sexual abuse was rife. A 2016 report found that in the past two decades, at least 368 gymnasts have alleged sexual abuse by coaches and other adults. If we're suddenly paying attention to their plight, it's thanks to the transformative justice of Judge Rose Marie Aquilina, said Sophie Gilbert in TheAtlantic.com. Her decision to allow 156 women to detail the agony they endured under Nasser and live stream it to the world was a watershed moment for sexual abuse survivors everywhere. Testifying about abuse can be a harrowing ordeal for survivors. Under Aquilina's guidance, it turned into an empowering act of catharsis. Even world-famous athletes like Raceman spoke of how confronting Nasser enabled them to overcome their own self-doubts. It wasn't until I started watching the other brave survivors, said Raceman, that I realized I, too, needed to be here. We can all learn an important lesson from this terrible story, said Frank Bruni in the New York Times. Nasser's modus operandi, grooming both his victims and the adults around them, is classic pedophile behavior. We saw it with Jerry Sandusky at Penn State and with thousands of Roman Catholic priests. In all those cases, supposedly respected members of the community spent years cultivating their young victims and parents, portraying themselves as altruistic authority figures who could improve kids' lives. Nasser offered a route to Olympic medals. Sandusky's victims' families were dazzled by the football glory at Penn State. Priests posed as agents of God. In condemning these men as monsters, we shouldn't overlook that they follow a common technique for gaining intimate access to young people, and looking out for it is the best way to protect the children from the other Nassers out there. Trump, a Davos man now. When President Trump dropped into Davos last week, he was entering the lion's den, said Larry Kudlow in NationalReview.com. With his populist impulses and disdain for international norms, Trump used to be reviled by the elitist heads of state, EU bureaucrats, and international CEOs who attend the annual World Economic Forum meeting in Switzerland. But he was welcomed to the glitzy mountaintop event with open arms. After an arrival ceremony fit for a rock star, the president delivered a well-received speech in which he eschewed his usual anti-free trade rhetoric, declaring the U.S. open for business and invited foreign corporations to invest in the U.S. America first, Trump said, does not mean America alone. The Davos crowd was visibly relieved, said Peter Goodman and Keith Bradshaw in the New York Times. Many departed the Swiss mountains feeling that Trump's extreme positions on trade were just aggressive bargaining postures, and that there was more method to his fits of pique than they had assumed. The reason Trump received a hero's welcome in Davos is simple, said Charles Gasparino in the New York Post. His pro-business tax cut and deregulation policies have sparked sustained economic growth and a roaring stock market. Even corporate leaders allied with the Democrats, such as J.P. Morgan's Jamie Dimon and Goldman Sachs' Lloyd Blankfein, were singing Trump's praises. It's hard to argue a success. But the Davos love-in also highlighted the emptiness of the president's populist rhetoric, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com. Having one office promising to tackle Wall Street greed and fight for hard-pressed working-class voters, Trump has instead signed a tax bill that explicitly favors corporations and the wealthy. His administration is a plutocratic government in a populist overcoat. Trump may have run as a populist, said Stephen Collision in CNN.com, but he clearly relished his acceptance by the global elite. As a self-promoting Queens-born real estate magnate in New York, he was always scorned by the city's old money business titans. At the White House Correspondents' Dinner in 2011, he was lacerated by President Obama as the D.C. in-crowd hooted at his humiliation. But in Davos, Trump was not only sitting at the global establishment's top table, he was the main draw. At 71, he had finally claimed his place among the global elite, whose members had long spurned him. And a couple of short notes here. Let's see. Washington lobbyists spent $3.34 billion trying to influence Congress in 2017, the highest level in 7 years, as corporations, trade groups, and other interests sought to shape tax cut legislation, regulatory issues, and other policies during President Trump's first year. Lobbyists appear not to have gotten the memo about draining the swamp, said Sheila Krumholtz of the Center for Responsive Politics. America's opioid epidemic is on track to claim 1 million lives by 2020. Every day, more than 175 Americans die from drug overdoses, the equivalent of a 737 crashing and killing all the passengers on board every single day. And we'll finish with a quote from Ursula Le Guin, quoted in ParisReview.org. All of us have to learn how to invent our lives, make them up, imagine them. If we don't, our lives get made up for us by other people. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.